Good morning and welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name is David Hinge. Glad to have you with us this morning. We're also pleased to have back with us once again Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic in Champaign. And once a month on a Thursday in the 10 o'clock hour, he's here and we talk about children's health. And we've been doing this for these many years because we thought people would like to have a regular chance to talk to a pediatrician and ask questions. So whatever's on your mind, can be a sickness issue, can be behavior development, all the kinds of things you could think of talking about with a pediatrician. You can do that here. And I know that Dr. Bocek will share whatever thoughts he's got. 333-9455. That's the number here in Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, once again, thank you very much.
Good morning. It's good to be here.
Well, we're now headed into, or we're certainly into the cough and cold season, and people may be headed to the drugstore for relief from some of their symptoms, particularly things like coughing and runny nose and congestion and sneezing and whatever. And maybe it's, as you suggested, it'd be a good thing to talk about because just recently, fairly recently, the government decided to withdraw one component that's in a lot of over-the-counter cold medicines, a decongestant, phenylpropanolamine, which is it's that thing that's in a lot of these medicines that, speaking for myself, I don't like, and I think a lot of other people don't like either because it makes you feel like you've had about 10 cups of coffee. It's a drug that's like adrenaline and gives you that really, unless you like that kind of thing, gives you that really sort of nasty buzz. And it's in one of those things that if you start reading the labels, you see this is in a lot of these medications. So that's gone. But maybe people are still going to have questions about, well, okay, what is in these things? What sort of drugs are there? And particularly if they're thinking about giving them to their children, is that okay? Should I be worried about that?
Probably not. Generally, I think what they were worried about with phenylpropanolamine is hemorrhagic stroke. And I suspect, I haven't seen any of the reports on it, but I suspect these were probably older folks with bad blood vessels anyway. And what these medications do, the decongestants tend to do, is they tend to cause the blood vessels to shut down a little bit. And so they deprive the mucus glands of blood, and the mucus glands make less mucus, but then again, there's less blood going to the heart and there's less blood going to the brain, so all the blood vessels are shut down. So I suspect that, yeah, people with diabetes and atherosclerotic heart disease and bad carotid arteries and that sort of stuff are at risk. And I would suspect that most people, healthy people, probably are not at any risk from these medications. But with any medication, you get the benefit-risk ratio. Does it make you feel better? And I'm not convinced from my own experience in practice or from reading the literature that these medications do an awful lot either. So you're running the risk of side effects, and I'm not sure you're getting much benefits out of them, much in the way of benefit out of them. What they do, the decongestants, phenylpropanolamine, which is now gone, ephedrine, pseudoephedrine, are the other major decongestants out in most of these products. What a lot of products, they tend to make you get a little bit hyper, like 5 cups of coffee. So what most of these do is then they throw in an antihistamine, which tends to sedate, and hopefully with the mixture of two, you come out
even.
But you never know how your individual child, because some antihistamines usually sedate, particularly in young children. Sometimes they can make them higher than a kite too. So if you've got them on an antihistamine that's making them higher than a kite and a decongestant that has no potential to sedate, you've got a real high child. And I'm not sure, again, you're getting much bang for the buck. I'm not sure the evidence is particularly good that it does relieve a lot of symptoms. Mm. Other common ingredients in these medications are guaifenesin. Plain Robitussin is guaifenesin, and that's supposed to be an expectorant. It's supposed to loosen the mucus and help you cough it up easier. Well, except that we've just given you decongestant that thickens the mucus and lessens it. And now we throw an expectorant in there too, And then the DM that you see in all these products, that's dextromethorphan, that's a cough suppressant. Well, I think you have to be careful with that, too, because if you have good reason to cough, you don't want to suppress it because you want to cough that stuff up. So a lot of these products seem to be intrinsically illogical.
Mm-hmm.
If unfortunately, they're ineffective, so it probably doesn't matter.
Well, I guess the one thing people might want to think about when they're looking at these products, because they are often they are a combination of things. They may have decongestant, antihistamine. They may have cough suppressant. Mm-hmm. They may very well have acetaminophen, which like Tylenol. So they'll have a pain reliever, and also something that will reduce fever. So it has all that stuff in there. So what you might want to do is think about, okay, what symptoms do I have and what symptoms do I really want to treat? And do I really need all of these things? Because it is also possible to get all of those things individually, mm-hmm. rather than take them all in one pill. So maybe you'd say, well, one of these things, maybe that's not so important. You know, if I'm not having a problem with a cough, if it's not keeping me awake at night, well, then maybe I don't need them.
Yeah. And the other problem I have with, especially the combinations with the fever reducers, with the acetaminophens mainly, is if you push the dose to get the correct dose of acetaminophen, you've pushed the dose of ephedrine and the antihistamines too high. So with the fixed drug combinations like that, you can get into, and I'm with you, I think I'd rather see you use single products for what symptom bothers you the most. And I think the way I'd treat a cold is if you have a fever and you feel achy and that, take some acetaminophen or ibuprofen, maybe run a humidifier, keep a box of Kleenex next to you, wash your hands frequently, and I think that's probably the way I'd treat a cold.
Yeah. I think that there was some years ago, and it's been a little while since I heard anything about this, but also I think some concern that people might be taking these combination medicines that had acetaminophen in them and then also taking additional Tylenol and getting an overdose of acetaminophen that can cause, I think, is it liver damage? So there, again, you ought to be at least think a little bit about what's in these things so that you know you don't end up taking more of something that you're already taking.
Yeah, get the dose right. Not too little, not too much. Just get it right.
We have a caller. Others are welcome. Dr. Robert Bocek is here. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. This is our monthly show on children's health. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Caller's in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi, doctor. I have a question for you. On Sunday, they had a segment on 60 Minutes regarding the MMR vaccine. I'm a big proponent of vaccinations, vaccinated all the shots for my 3-year-old. Now I have a 5-month-old. They didn't convince me on the report that the not taking the vaccine was going to be beneficial to her, but why did the study cause such a scare with autism? I don't think they really got in the report to the heart of the matter on proving that this vaccine could cause autism. And if I could take the answer off the air, if you could tell me how you weigh in on the issue. Thank you.
All right. Well, thanks very much for the call. We appreciate it.
I'm a strong supporter of the MMR. I'm a strong supporter of all the vaccines we have available. I think autism and MMR, a few people have tried to link that for years. It's never held up under good scrutiny, good scientific scrutiny. There's no proof, and I think we have just tons of proof about the mortality, morbidity rate of measles prior to, I think that vaccine's been out since 67, I think it first came out. And I think there's no, measles is still a big killer of children in underdeveloped countries. And here we have virtually wiped out, we rarely see a case of measles. I'm not sure if I think maybe a handful of cases are reported a year. We well know what rubella does if a pregnant woman catches rubella, how devastating that could be to the baby. Mumps probably is more of an inconvenience than a tremendous dastardly disease, but I'm a strong supporter of MMR. We've been using it for years. Are we seeing an increase in reports of autism? Yes and no. I think we've sort of changed the diagnostic criteria for autism, so we're diagnosing milder and milder cases, but again, there's been no scientific proof whatsoever linking MMR with autism or with I don't think anything else, any other diseases.
And I think with the case with autism is it's still something of a mystery. We really don't know what causes it.
We don't know. Yeah, these children are wired differently for some reason or other.
Okay.
And we really don't know, but there's no link to infectious disease, there's no link to vaccines.
All right. Well, I hope that gets a question to the caller. We'll continue. Let's go to Rantoul for somebody else here, line two.
Hi. Actually, my question is related to this. I already have an autistic child.
Okay.
I am expecting I have an autistic boy who's 7, and I have a 2.5-year-old who is severely speech delayed. He's otherwise okay. And I'm expecting my 4th in about 3 weeks. And my sister is so terrified of the autism connection that her child is completely unvaccinated. And so we're going to go to Christmas with a 3-week-old baby to visit a completely unvaccinated 18-month-old. Is there anything that I need to be concerned about if the kid is not actually ill? And on the second level, have you ever been asked for the separated vaccines or the vaccines without mercury in them? And if so, can you get them from Christie?
I don't know what vaccines still have mercury in it. I know it's been pulled out of the hepatitis B vaccine.
Mm-hmm.
They're working. I think it's still in some of the other vaccines. They're working hard to get rid of it altogether, but I think it's still in most of the vaccines except the MMR. The other thing, though, as far as the mercury is concerned, there's a great debate. There's very, very little mercury in these vaccines. It's used as a preservative. Mm-hmm. There's very, very little mercury in these vaccines. Again, there's no scientific data whatsoever there's no consensus about what a toxic level of mercury is, what an abnormally high blood level of mercury is. So again, the major concern was with the hepatitis B vaccine, newborns getting it.
Right.
So they were, relative to a 2 or 3 year old or a 6 month old even, they were getting a relatively higher dose of mercury per kilogram of body weight, say. We've been using the DPT vaccine has had mercury in it ever since it came out, and I can't remember when that came out in the 40s or something like that, I think. So we have had mercury in the vaccines, and it's been very, very low dose, and I'm not terribly concerned about that at all. Would I wait on vaccinations till the mercury-free vaccines come out? No, especially when we're talking about young children, infants and young children and the pertussis vaccine. As far as your visit over Christmas, I think your sister's wrong. I think she should have her children vaccinated. I think she's going to be in trouble when it becomes school age because the state mandates them at that time. But as far as your visit, if her kids are healthy, go ahead. Have a Merry Christmas with them.
Okay. Have you read the newest thing from Andrew Wakefield in The Lancet? I haven't been able to get over to see it, but I couldn't follow the abstract that was printed in the newsletter I get.
No.
About the measles in the guts of autistic kids.
Okay.
He's done two things, and I know the first one was a really more of a case study than anything else. And the second one, he supposedly had control groups and whatnot, and I just couldn't follow his abstract.
Okay, no, I didn't see it. I'm sorry. I think we've got another problem with the MMR vaccine and associated with anything, since particularly in the United States, every kid gets two doses. Europe, for some reason, Europe's much more laissez-faire about immunizations, not requiring them. But I don't think I've not seen any reports that we have excessive numbers of autistic children in our country versus other countries.
Mm-hmm.
And you would think that, now we can't compare with underdeveloped countries because they have other things to worry about besides autism. But in the European countries where MMR may not be universal, I've not seen any reports that, we have more autism in this country than they do in the United Kingdom or Switzerland or any country that may not be doing it.
Okay. Well, I was just interested if you could get the separated MMR here or not.
No. You can get an MR. You can get a measles rubella. I don't think it comes as a measles alone.
Okay.
And the recommendation is if there's question about measles, go ahead with the MMR.
Okay.
What she was asking, if you didn't want to get the measles, but you wanted to get the mumps and rubella, you can't do it. You can't do it.
You can't
Actually,
do it.
Actually, I'm interested in getting all three. I just want to get them separately.
Separately?
Oh.
Yeah, you can't do it.
No, okay, you can't do it here.
Can't do it here.
Okay, that's what I needed to know.
Okay, thanks very much for the call. Our guest here this morning on Focus 580, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic, and each month he's here on the program. We do these programs on children's health. It's always on a Thursday, and we built this into the schedule so that you'll know that at least one time a month there'll be a pediatrician here. You got questions you can ask. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. Another Urbana person, they're next, and it's line one. Hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good,
fine, thanks.
Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My wife and I are going through a divorce right now, and I haven't lived with the kids for about 4 months, and when I do see them on a regular basis, I'm interested in finding how they feel, and when I talk to them, I don't know if I'm doing it the right way to find out how they're going through with it all. Would you have any suggestions or resources where I could find out how to do that a little better?
I guess the couple, I don't pump them. I think what I'd do is I'd have fun with them, I'd have dinner with them, and, you know, have good times with them, and listen.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's mainly listening. Don't pump them for how old are they?
They're 4 and 5.
Okay. Probably they're doing perfectly fine. I'll bet you they're happy as can be, by and large, at this point in time in their lives. But I think the other rule I will give you is no blame ever goes on them. Their mother is not bad-mouthed in front of them. The reason for the divorce had nothing to do with them. The problems you may now be having with custody and child support and all that sort of stuff aren't their problems. Leave them out of it. Be a father to them.
Sounds like good advice.
Leave them out of it. Just be a father to them. And I think the other thing in my experience is it's not, I guess what I've often linked divorce to is kind of a death, the grieving process. Something's been lost, and they've got to grieve. And this grief can go on for years before it's resolved. And in my I think what I've dealt with in my practice recently is teenagers who are now feeling done to, even though the divorce happened, 10 or 15 years ago, that they still resent it. So I think be open to them, listen to them. I think so often one of the mistakes we make with teenagers is we talk at them, and we don't listen to their feelings. And so I think just make the opportunity to listen to their feelings non-judgmentally. If they ask for advice, please give it to them. But I think my best advice is listen to them. And listen to them, listen to their report cards. Listen to how they're doing with friends. And as long as they're doing well interpersonally with their friends, as long as their report cards are okay, as long as they have a good relationship with both you and and their mother, I think things are going as well as can be expected.
My son is, the teacher said that he is doing very well in the academic part. He's only in kindergarten, but as far as that developmental side, but she has noticed some behavior problems, just acting up, things that he hadn't seemed to have been inured to in the past. And how could I sort of remedy that? Is there counseling or something like that that we could take advantage of, or just kind of to nip it in the bud before it gets,
Yeah, I think if he's functioning reasonably well, He's not in trouble. Counseling may not. You might want to go to counseling just to get a couple of sessions to see if there's a problem.
Yeah.
See if the counselor picks up a problem. I think the other thing, what kind of relationship do you have with your ex-wife?
It's good.
Okay.
It's good.
I think that's very important to stay in communication with her so you're both following. I think one of the big problems I hear in the office is, you know, they love living with their father because there's no rules at dad's house.
Right.
Well, I guess the other problem I have dealing with parents is I hear from one parent or the other, but I seldom hear from both. So who's telling the truth?
Mm-hmm.
But I think if you can keep in contact with your wife, so you're both on the same game plan.
Yeah, correct.
So you're prioritizing the same behaviors. So you're communicating. If one's noticing a problem, hey, have you got the problem too? And if you do, how are you dealing with it? That helps work. But mainly keep your eyes open, or keep your ears open and listen to them. Keep your eyes open and watch them. But sort of, I think if you know, how you doing? Just great, Dad. And why are you asking? You have to listen for the alternate agenda.
Great. Well, thanks for answering my question.
All right.
You're welcome.
Thank you for the call. We got some other folks here ready to go. Next up will be Champagne. That is line number 3. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Vocek.
Good morning.
I have sort of a developmental question. Is it normal for a 10, almost 11-year-old girl to not be able to freely wink either eye voluntarily? She can sort of wink her right eye, but it amounts to putting both eyes shut and then opening the left eye, and she can't voluntarily wink her left eye at all.
Yeah, some people just can't wink. Now, when she sleeps, she closes her eyes.
Oh, yeah.
She can close her eyes and blink and all that.
Yes.
Some people just can't wink. Just like some people can wiggle their ears, some can't. Some just can't wink. And it's not a deficit. It's nothing to worry about.
Okay, it just turned out to be a little bit of a nuisance for things like looking in the microscope or a telescope.
Actually, when you look through a microscope, if she's going to be a researcher, she's going to have a binocular microscope. Anyway, the other thing we learn as we look through a microscope is we keep both eyes open because you get tired if you're scrunching one shut. So you can look. You learn to look through a microscope with both eyes open. You just don't see through. Yeah, you just sort of the brain closes one eye, if you will. So she's really not at a tremendous deficit there. So I don't think the ability to not wink is going to handicap her in any way.
But it isn't terribly abnormal.
No, we'll see it often enough.
All right, thank you.
You're
all
welcome.
Right. We're at our midpoint here. And again, just tell you that our guest is Dr. Robert Vocek. He's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic. He's on the program every month. On a Thursday, we do these shows on children's health. And if you have questions, you can call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. And toll-free anywhere that you can hear us around Illinois, Indiana, 800-222-9455. To Aurora, line number 4 for next person. Hello.
Yes, hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How's your family doing?
Well, I think well.
Good.
Saturday night, we had a birthday party for my mother. She's 105 on Sunday.
Wow.
And what was a lot of fun, I hope was a lot of fun for the grandchildren, she said the grace in Slovak, and to hear her voice so loud and strong, it was just a blessing, really truly a blessing.
Great.
What I wanted to talk about was, years ago, I put up a bulletin board. I had seen my sister-in-law do this, of all the pictures, and as they went through first grade up to seventh, eighth grade, and then high school, and then I thought, well, and it's in my entry room, and as the people, children, adults come through, they glance at the pictures, and I, you know, continue to change them, rearrange them, and that kind of thing, and add to them. It's been really a source of fun, and I thought, well, now the children are getting older, they won't be interested in it anymore, and I've put up the grandsons with their girlfriends when they went to the prom, and that kind of thing. And now, Saturday night, it was just so much fun because they come in with their girlfriend and then tell the family, her about who's who in the family. And explain the pictures and who they are and where they fit in the family. And it's just been more fun than I could ever imagine when I originally put it up. It's been a lot of fun, and I just thought I'd tell about it because it's easier to explain with something concrete like a picture who's who in the family and where they live, and the geography that comes into it also these days with our very moving, you know, family. And so it's fun to hear them laughing about a baby picture, you know, and that kind of thing. And when my grandson got his license at 16, there he was standing with his, you know, driving permit. It's a very good history, a story. And so I just thought of it's just been so positive and fun. And I think that's what we need these days is a lot of laughter and a lot of fun. And then the thing I did have one question and I will hang up. What do you do with a 9-year-old that uses illness as a means of getting her own way? You take a temp, and where do you go from there? And I'll hang up and listen for your answer.
Right. Okay. I think you don't. You know, I think we've talked a lot about temper tantrums. You don't let temper tantrums, you know, rule the household. And I think as kids get older, they learn that temper tantrums don't work, so they go to whining, and then they go to you know, gee, I don't feel good, I can't go to school today, or I don't feel good, I can't do this and that. And I think you're on to it. You know, gee, you don't have a temperature, you're going to school. You haven't thrown up, you're going to school. And usually, for the most part, when these kids get to school, they usually kind of forget what they were complaining about in the first place, and they get involved with school, and they forget about their complaints. Yeah, sometimes you're going to be wrong, and sometimes by the time they get, you're going to get a call from school about noon that their temp's 101 or 102. Please come and pick them up. But for the most part, I think you've got good judgment. You've been around children enough. I think you've got good judgment. And when you think they're faking, kind of, I'm not sure I'd call them fakers, but I think you'd say, well, it doesn't look like you're sick enough to miss school. So away you go.
Okay. Hope that helps. We have another caller and plenty of time for others. You want to give us a call, talk with Dr. Bochak, 333-WILL, toll free, 800-222-WILL. And up next, back here locally, Urbana, line 2. Hello.
Hi. I had a question about the chickenpox vaccine. I'd heard different things about it. My kids haven't had the chickenpox, and one thing that I heard was that it's possible that if you do the vaccine, it could delay them getting it when they're young. Then they'll get it when they're older, and it's worse when they're older. And so I'm confused about whether or not it's a good idea.
I like this vaccine. Historically, we're using the Ocos strain of the vaccine. It was developed in Japan. There's been 20 years of widespread experience with it. Some of the guinea pigs, the initial recipients of the vaccine, are 30 years ago. It still seems to be effective. So there's no recommendations for boosters at this time. It's being watched by the government, by the CDC. It's being watched by the drug company, of course, because they'd sure like to give everybody a second dose. It'd be good for their stockholders. But so far, I think we can very safely say it's good for 20 years. Looks like it's good for 30 years. We think it's good for life because it is a live viral vaccine. Is it 100% effective? No. It's got about a 10 or 15% partial failure rate, let's say, that about 10 or 15% of the kids who get the vaccine will get a diagnosable case of chickenpox, although by all areas of measurement, it seems to be much milder than what we'd expect. Fewer skin lesions, lower temperatures, so that's why I say it's a partial failure only. But how old are your children now?
I have 4 that are 7, ranging from 7 to 1.
Okay. Because the other thing about chickenpox is the older the child when they get the illness, the more severe it tends to be.
Right, and I've been surprised that my 7-year-old has been exposed numerous times and still hasn't gotten it. And so now I'm starting to wonder if the vaccine would be a good idea.
I would. The other thing you could do with the 7-year-old is do a blood test, do a titer to see if, unbeknownst to you, the 7-year-old had a real mild infection. But, you know, I really doubt that because you've got 4 other children. So if your 7-year-old had a mild infection, the other rule is the one who brings it home has the mildest infection, and then the sibs seem to get a more severe infection. So it's a bit hard for me to believe that your 7-year-old even had a mild infection because you might have missed it in the 7-year-old because it could have been so mild. But one of the other 3 kids certainly would have blossomed well and would have been very easily diagnosable.
Right.
So, and the other thing, you could do a blood test. That costs about $60 to get a titer, or $30, somewhere in there. Anyway, the blood test and the vaccine are about the same price.
Uh-huh.
And if you do the blood test to see if they really need the vaccine, and then you find out, as I would guess in this case, this child has not had chickenpox, then you end up with the shot anyway, and the child's not terribly delighted with you forgetting two sticks.
Right.
And the bill payer's not terribly delighted with you either for running up the bill. And what's the danger if you are immune to chickenpox and you get the vaccine? Basically, what you get is a booster dose, no harmful effects.
Okay.
And the other thing we worry about chickenpox is shingles later on in life. And there's no report so far of the chickenpox vaccine is a live viral vaccine. There's no reports thus far, and again, we're talking about 20 years, of shingles resulting from the vaccine. So it seems to be, I like the vaccine. You know, again, we're not saving a lot of lives with the chickenpox vaccine, at least in the developed countries. We're saving a fair number of hospitalizations. Mostly, I think what we can really say is, you know, we're saving these kids and their parents a week of discomfort to misery and a week of missed school.
Right.
And maybe we're lessening the risk of them ever getting shingles in their life later on.
Okay. Thank you very much.
You're
okay,
welcome.
Thanks for the call. That you just right got the question I was thinking about asking. The chickenpox and shingles are both caused by the same virus. It's herpes zoster. So one of the herpes viruses. And what happens is when you get the chickenpox when you're little and you have that disease, and then the virus goes and hides.
Yeah.
And then in some people, not in everybody, but in some people later it manifests as shingles. So. But in this case now, if you can prevent, you're giving a live virus, but you're preventing them from having the chickenpox. So, but it's an open question whether or not this also would then be a preventive for shingles.
I think we can't say that yet because shingles can be decades after the after the primary infection. So I think we can't, you know, I can't honestly say we're preventing shingles with it. But it looks so far after 20 years of data that there's not been a reported case of shingles in a vaccinated child. And we will see shingles in children. It's more common in adults, but we will see shingles in children. Nice thing about shingles in children, if you can say there's a nice thing about shingles in children, is it tends to be one time. It doesn't tend to scar, and it doesn't tend to give you a neuropathy. You don't have the pain around your side forever the way adults can. It's more... Chickenpox is more miserable in adults. Shingles is more miserable in adults. But yeah, they're both that's the same virus. And the herpes family of viruses, the cold sore virus, herpes simplex likes to hide too and in the nerve roots and come back out as a canker sore, or it can also cause a vaginal infection, vaginal herpes that tends to be recurrent.
I'm wondering, given the fact that chickenpox is a pretty contagious disease, and the way people get it, you know, as kids, is they get it from some other kid, either at school or playmate or neighbor or sibling or whatever. How common is it that somebody should get to age 7 and not have encountered it?
I would guess, and I don't know, and I think the caller's off the line now. What's happened with chickenpox recently with the advent of daycares and that is we used to see the prime age for chickenpox was 5, 6, 7 years of age, kindergarten, first grade sort of thing. Now the prime age of chickenpox is like the 3, 4-year-old because of daycares and nursery schools and that sort of stuff. And I would guess perhaps that this 7-year-old wasn't a daycare, was a home-raised child, mother at home child, parent at home child, mm-hmm. and was a home-raised child and just didn't get exposed to it, and all the peers in the classroom had already had it prior to starting school and snuck by that way. Sometimes you just get lucky. One of my fellow residents came down with chicken pox at age, I don't know, how old were we then? We were much younger then, but yeah, old, you know, into adult life by then. So some people do sneak through. You know, we'll see adults come down with chicken pox every once in a while. Some do sneak through. It's unusual. I think it's something like only 3% of adults, 3% of the people arrive at adulthood without having had chicken pox. So it's most unusual. And it's very, very contagious. It's almost, if it gets into the household, it's almost guaranteed that anybody who hasn't had chicken pox is going to get it. That's one of our most contagious diseases.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician at Christie Clinic. And once a month on a Thursday, we do these shows on children's health. And if you have questions, you can call 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. So do you folks over at your place have enough flu vaccine? Have you been able to give it to all the people who want it?
No. Mm. We did until the last week, and then they shut down the influenza vaccine clinic. We've got a temporary shortage. We hope that it will be over soon. And we sort of shut down the general, come on and get your flu shot. We've still got it for those at high risk, those with heart disease or chronic lung disease or diabetes and that sort of stuff. So we've still got it available. We just don't have the doors open for everybody walking off the street. And I'm glad you mentioned it because flu epidemics, the CDC finally fessed up. You know what? They usually don't pop until January, so you still have all of November and most of December to get your flu vaccines. And again, there's two populations, those who should have it that I mentioned, mm-hmm. and then anybody else is welcome to it. And does it guarantee a well winter? No. It just guarantees that, it doesn't guarantee much of. It guarantees that if they're guessing right in the strains of flu that they're predicting come out, you will be protected against that. You'll still get parainfluenza and adenovirus and all the other viral infections that are out there. But influenza we can protect and prevent, hopefully, if they've guessed the right strains. And they probably have guessed the right strains to put in the vaccine. I keep hearing in the office people say that this is going to be a terrible flu year and that the strains coming around this year are going to be just disastrous. And I don't know, maybe.
How does anybody know that?
I don't know. But certainly I've had my flu shot and I think they're good ideas.
Yeah. So given one of the things that people need to remember, I guess, is that it takes a little time for the immunity to be established. Yeah. So if you get a shot today and you get exposed to the flu tomorrow, it's not going to do it. But if somebody, if somebody got their flu shot within the next month, chances are they probably would be okay. Then by the time they'd be likely to be exposed, their immunity would be up and running. It should be okay.
For most people, they've had flu, so this is essentially kind of a booster dose. So probably within a week, 10 days, you've had your immune system's had its amnestic response, mm-hmm. and you're probably protected.
Do you think that seemed like part of the problem here was that there was some difficulty in manufacturing the virus? But I also heard people, some health people say, well, maybe whoever it was that was making the recommendation, whether it was the CDC or somebody else about who should get the shot, kind of went overboard and virtually said, everybody should get it, so that not only was there a problem with supply, but that the demand was a little bit greater because now people were saying, oh, gosh, maybe I should have this, who in the past didn't and weren't interested.
I think mostly there were technical difficulties. For some reason, the viruses didn't want to grow in culture, so there were technical difficulties making the vaccine, and that's why it came out a little bit late, and there's some supply problems.
Yeah, and since it's still the case that eggs are used in the manufacture of this, so if you have an egg allergy, that means you can't get the shot, and then are you out of luck then?
Yeah, maybe. I think there's still controversy about this, and most people who've studied it say that these vaccines are so purified that there's really... Yeah, although the viruses may have been grown on egg, yolk, that they're so purified that there's still debate whether you should, if you're egg sensitive, whether you can have the vaccines or not. And it seems that it's coming around to, hey, go ahead, because the vaccines are so pure. There's probably no egg protein in there at all, and they're probably safe to give if you're egg sensitive. But, yeah, if you're egg sensitive, I think I'd talk to your doctor. I don't think I'd go through one of the drive-thru, roll down your window, hang your arm out.
Yeah.
I think I'd do that more individually and carefully and see what your own doctor thinks.
All right. Well, again, we have time for some other questions here. If something's on your mind having to do with children's health, you are invited to call 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455 or WILO.
I guess we get stuck on vaccines a lot.
Well,
that's okay.
That's pretty much a big part of what pediatricians do.
That's right. And I think let me talk briefly about the Prevnar vaccine. And we mentioned it once before, the pneumococcal vaccine. And I think one of the ways I got on Focus 580 in the first place was when the Haemophilus influenza B vaccine came out. I guess 20 years ago now.
yeah, something like that.
And the Haemophilus influenza B is a bacteria that was responsible for, as I recall, about 17,000 cases of meningitis a year. So this vaccine came out and just knocked the socks off of, it just knocked the number of cases of meningitis we saw in kids way, way down. There were some problems when that vaccine first came out. We could only give it to kids over 2 years of age, because it was a polysaccharide vaccine, and kids under 2 years of age don't respond well to polysaccharide vaccines. So somebody stuck a protein on there, and bam, away we went. We had a good vaccine to knock the socks off of Haemophilus influenza B bacteria, or meningitis. Well, Streptococcus pneumonia, I think probably everybody's heard about in the news, because it's become resistant to multiple antibiotics. It also causes meningitis, amongst other infections, but meningitis is probably the most serious infection. It, again, we've had the vaccine for, 15, 20 years, something like that, but it, too, was a polysaccharide vaccine, so kids under two didn't form antibodies to the vaccine. And recently, I think about 6 months ago, they came out with, a protein conjugate vaccine to protect against Streptococcus pneumonia. The one we have out now has seven different serotypes of pneumococcus in it, which cause 95% of the diseases we see. And so it is now a recommended vaccine in all children up till 2 years of age. This bacteria likes to cause problems, as most diseases do, in the very young and the very old. It's out, and I do recommend it. It's estimated to cause about 1,400 cases of meningitis a year, so a lot less than the old Haemophilus influenza B did. The thing about this meningitis is it's uglier than Haemophilus influenza B meningitis. It's got a lot higher mortality rate. It's got a lot higher morbidity rate or brain damage rate afterwards, and I like all vaccines. Maybe someday they'll put me out of business. I doubt it. But I think any disease we can safely prevent, let's do it. Mm.
Here's the question that is not about something that's earth-shaking or life-threatening. But I happen to live not very far from the Urbana High School. So I walk along there, Washington Street, on my way to work. And sometimes I see kids going to school. And this time of the year, one starts to see kids that are inappropriately dressed. And here's the latent dad coming out in me, I guess. You see him going along, and they're obviously cold. They don't have a good coat. They don't have a hat. They don't have a scarf. They don't have gloves. And you want to say, son, why did you leave the house that way? Didn't you know that it was going to be cold? Didn't you listen to Ed Kieser? But having been a child myself, I guess I know that, you get certain ideas. Is that something either to particularly to be worried about? Or when you see them headed out and you know that it's cold outside and they're just wearing a little sweatshirt and none of the other accoutrements, is that just a losing battle and you say, fine, you're going to be cold?
Yeah.
That's your call there. Until it gets to the point where frostbite would maybe be an issue.
I think that's the only thing. No, they're not going to get influenza or cold or anything like that. They're just going to get goose pimples. And, if they should pass out someplace or faint or something like that, they could have suffer hypothermia. But outside of that, that's not a battle. That in the messy room is not a battle as a parent mm-hmm. I'd choose to take on.
Mm-hmm. Well, anything here? We've got a couple minutes left. Anything sort of general you might want to drop on people? Maybe now we're headed into the holidays. Anything that's particularly holiday related?
Yeah, I think if you're Christmas shopping, again, pay attention to what you think your child would like, not what you'd like. If you want an electric train and your kid's 2 years old, buy yourself an electric train, but don't say it's a children's gift. Make sure that the gift is appropriate for the child. You know, if it says up till 5 years of age, I don't care how bright your child is, it's probably, you know, been tested up through 5 years of age. Check the toys. Some of the toys, especially some of the imported toys, I mean, we get a list of recalls all the time, you know, about the small parts that they might aspirate and that sort of stuff. So, yeah, you might examine the toys when you get them home or rattle the box, see if it sounds like there's too many small parts. But I think make the toys appropriate for the child and not something they'll grow into, because something they grow into is probably going to collect dust in the basement and they're not going to enjoy it, or maybe harmful. And yeah, if you want to treat yourself, treat yourself. But if you're getting a present for your child, make sure it's for the child. Bike should fit the child. They shouldn't be grown into. I wish all bikes were created with bike helmets. But make the holidays, like the earlier caller did and talked about the pictures, reminiscing and that sort of stuff. Keep the holidays, keep the spirit of holidays. You know, Christmas wasn't invented by Berkners. It's not a Berkner's holiday. And, you know, if you're Christian, yeah, focus on that. If you're not Christian, well, you know, do whatever you want, you know, whatever is appropriate for your family that way. But again, it wasn't started by Berkners or Cole.
Not that we have anything against Berkners,
no,
of course.
No.
Well, thank you very much.
It's good to be here.
We're pleased to have you here. Dr. Robert Bocek, he's a pediatrician from Christie Clinic in Champaign. He's with us once a month. It's always a Thursday, and he will be back again next month, and we will do the show again.